May it please the court? And I, unfortunately, I think good afternoon is more appropriate than good morning. As Judge Price has often told me when I've been before you, a trial should be a search for truth, in which the finder of fact sifts through what it hears and then decides the case, applying the law to those facts. That process is subverted when a prosecutor's animus against a defendant combines with flawed evidentiary rulings to both preclude the fact finder from hearing relevant evidence and then from to allow the fact finder to consider that which it should not. This morning I'd like to focus the court's attention on two aspects of Mr. McFadden's case that clearly demonstrate how far this trial strayed from that search for truth. I'd like to first focus briefly on point 12 of our brief and then address point 1. You know, when I reread the transcript in preparation for this argument, I was once again taken aback. To paraphrase Mr. Larner, this is the most egregious closing argument I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of them. This court and the Eighth Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court have spoken with one voice about how we are to review prosecutorial misconduct in closing argument. We look at due process principles and Eighth Amendment principles, and especially with respect to a capital case, heightened scrutiny must be used in order to look at those closing arguments to make sure that nothing violates either due process or Eighth Amendment. Especially in this case, I think this court may and should look at the office from which this case came, St. Louis County, because that office has repeatedly been told by the courts, by the Eighth Circuit, especially by this court, that those arguments are improper. Newland, Weaver, Antwine, Schern, in all of those cases, reversals were had because that office repeatedly ignored what has been the core of jurisprudence on improper closing arguments. In this case, and again, I'd just like to briefly address some of the highlights or lowlights of what happened in this case. The prosecutor in this case, Mr. Larner, told this jury that he inserted himself into the case. He told the jury that he had listened to everything in this case. He hadn't found anything redeeming or mitigating. He didn't hear anything. He said, I listened to the mitigation. I didn't hear anything redeeming or mitigating about this defendant. He told those jurors not to be guided by their own conscience, not to be guided by the law, but to listen to his opinion, him as the elected or one part of the elected officials of St. Louis County. Just like in State versus Story, he encouraged the jurors to put themselves in the shoes of the families of the victims in this case, to feel their pain. Specifically, he told them, ladies and gentlemen, everyone who has a sister or a brother hopes and prays they never had to endure the pain and suffering that these families have had to endure by someone with a cruel and evil intent that man had, because you see now how fleeting innocent life can be. Think of the terror that Leslie went through. Think of the terror that Todd went through. Think of the terror that Ms. Franklin, when she came home, went through. Think of the terror that Eva went through when she watched her sister get killed. Think of that. Again, just like this court specifically condemned in Story and in Rhodes, he encouraged those jurors to put themselves into the shoes of those families. He encouraged them to use emotion in deciding this case, to personalize this case to them. He also, and I think this is problematic again because of the place that this case comes out of, St. Louis County, he encouraged this jury to look to an external source of law in deciding this case and told them to look and again decide on emotion. And he told them, now, ladies and gentlemen, we live in a civilized society, but there was a time when civil society wasn't so civilized, and we would have given the families an opportunity for retribution. We would have let them hunt him down like he deserves. But we don't live in that society, he said. We gave him a fair trial. We put on evidence. He has a right to a lawyer, a jury of his peers. the only reason that argument was made was to remind those jurors of something that should never, ever occur in a courtroom in this state, the specter of vigilante justice, especially in a capital case, is simply unforgivable. Finally, and I'll just briefly go over this, and Judge Breckenridge, your comment in the disciplinary counsel hearing case earlier this morning made me think of this again, because in this case, Mr. Larner repeatedly told the jurors to take what should have been mitigating evidence and consider it as aggravation. He told them essentially that being normal is aggravating. He told them that not having a mental disease is aggravating. He told them to not be mentally retarded is aggravating. He told them that having a supporting family is aggravating. He told them that having average grades in school is aggravating. He told them that since Mr. McFadden had never been sexually abused, that was aggravating. He told them that because he has never been physically abused, that was aggravating. And he finally said, now sometimes we hear people are too young to get the death penalty. That doesn't apply here. Too insane, too crazy, too retarded. That kind of comment so clearly violates Zant versus Stevens. Again, it's impossible to find an argument that fits that so well.
Was any objection made to any of that?
Unfortunately not, Your Honor. And I can't tell you why not. I assume that if this court does not resolve that issue here, we'll hear why on the post-conviction action. Again, as Mr. Blackwell has acknowledged in his brief, Zant versus Stevens teaches that the state may not turn mitigators into aggravators. The prosecutor didn't just put a thumb on death side of the scales when he made this argument. He put a fist down. He told them, consider everything that must be or that should be considered as mitigation. Consider that to be aggravation. And he basically made a mockery of the whole purpose of the capital punishment scheme, because what we're looking for in this whole process is to only apply the death penalty to those few people for whom it is just, it is apt. And he's basically saying that for everybody, the death penalty is appropriate. Again, I think that is a clear violation of this court's teachings, especially in Story, in Rhodes. It violates teachings from the Eighth Circuit in Copeland, in Weaver, in Schern, in Antwine, in Newland. It violates the teachings of the U.S. Supreme Court in the Berger case, and I would request that this court vacate Mr. McFadden's sentence and resentence him to life without parole for those reasons. Just as with the state's closing argument, however, the situation involving Michael Douglas, which appears as point one in our brief, also reveals a trial in which the search for truth was subverted. Everyone at this scene agreed that Michael Douglas was the first shooter. He pulled a gun out of his pants and shot Todd Franklin, first in the head, then in the side. The testimony was that only after Todd Franklin was on the ground did Vince McFadden take the gun and shoot Todd. In penalty phase closing, the prosecutor, Mr. Larner, told the jury that Vince McFadden was the more culpable of the two, that he was the leader, that he had brought Michael Douglas into his web of violence, as he called it. The problem here was that this jury never heard in either phase that Michael got, as the initial shooter, a plea deal wherein he pled to murder second and got a 20-year sentence.
What did they hear?
What they heard, Judge, is kind of convoluted in how it went down, but what they heard was that he pled. They never heard the extent of the plea. And as this court has said,
They heard that he had a plea bargain, and as part of that plea, did they hear as part of that plea bargain, he got less than the maximum sentence?
They did.
Did they hear that he had an out date from prison?
They did. That was actually elicited by Mr. Larner. And our position is that even if that information, the information about the 20-year sentence, was not initially admissible, it certainly should have been admissible when Mr. Larner opened the door to it.
You're saying by indicating that there's an out date, they needed to be able to show how many years the sentence was?
In this case, I think it's critical because what we're talking about is Michael Douglas's motivation for recanting the story that he had told to defense counsel and, in fact, to also to Mr. Larner back in jail a few months before this trial. Because he had told him at that point that what had actually happened was he and his brother and Mr. McFadden were walking along. Todd Franklin and his friends came towards them. One of Mr. Franklin's associates shot. Mr. Douglas shot too, gave chase. The guy who had shot took off, but Mr. Douglas followed Mr. Franklin to this place where the final shooting happened, and he, at that point, he shot. He was unwilling to testify to the reason that he wasn't willing to say that on the stand was because he was afraid he was going to lose the benefit of this cushy deal, this sweetheart deal that he had gotten. He was afraid of a perjury charge. And despite what Mr. Larner told the judge said to the judge, well, he could only get 7 years on a perjury charge. Well, no, that's not true. Because as we know, the statute's very clear. When you're looking at a perjury charge and you're testifying in a first-degree murder case, that becomes an A felony. So he was looking at 10 to 30 or life, which would substantially enhance his rationale for saying to Mr. Larner, oh, yeah, you know, here in court, I'm saying Vince McFadden was the other shooter. But if I don't have that perjury charge sitting there, you know, maybe I'm willing to say something.
And I'm not following. The sentence on the perjury charge, the relevant sentence, was that this was a capital case, right?
But for the perjury charge, the perjury statute says that when you are testifying in a murder case.
And the murder case we're talking about is this murder case.
Correct. Correct. Correct.
And so the sentence that would be potential is based on what the range of punishment or the nature of the crime is in this case, not in his own case.
Exactly. And that's why when Mr. Larner tells the court, well, he could only get 7 years on the perjury, that was a misstatement. That was misleading to the court.
But that didn't have anything to do with whether they should have learned that he plea bargain for a sentence of 20 years.
I think it does, Judge, because in part, this court in State versus Edwards, a 1982 decision of this court, the court recognized that even when a witness admits he has an interest or a bias, the extent of the interest is also admissible. And so just that he got a deal isn't really the end of the game. It's the sweetheart part of the deal. And when you're looking at somebody having a 20-year sentence versus serving a life sentence perjury.
We did hear that he got an outdate. So
we heard that he got an outdate, but counsel argued to the court that that's not really sufficient, that in the heat of the moment, that really didn't tell this jury what exactly that meant. And to give them a full flavor of his interest, the extent of his interest in telling Mr. Larner on the stand, yeah, Mr. McFadden was the shooter.
Is there another case with a similar fact situation where a court is reversed because of not allowing the defense to put on how much of a break on sentence the witness got?
You know, I haven't found anything that's similar, but I think this court's recent discussion in the Jermaine Clark case can be helpful. In that case, while factually distinguishable, I think it's the motivation of the witness to say what they say, to perhaps tweak the facts a bit, that's what's relevant, and that's why we need to explore it in terms of a confrontation clause kind of violation. That's what we need to be looking at. This man's interest in protecting a 20-year sentence is critical. And I think that was what was discussed in that Jermaine Clark case.
Didn't you all call Douglas? Did the defense call Mr. Douglas?
Yes, we did, Judge.
So it wasn't a cross-examination situation. The other thing I was going to say is that it was clear that the jury heard that the sentence that his cohort received was less than a maximum. So clearly they know it was not the death penalty, it was something less. So how does that prejudice your client when clearly the jury heard that the co-conspirator got less?
Again, Judge, I think it becomes the extent of the deal. It's not simply the deal, but it's the extent of the deal. And especially
not getting death isn't enough to provide an incentive?
Number one, as Mr. Lerner, in fact, elicited, this Michael was a juvenile, so he wasn't even eligible for the death penalty.
Very good point.
But, you know, when you're looking at a life sentence and saying less than the maximum, these people had been voir dired only on the extent of punishment in a capital case. They weren't voir dire. These are not a bunch of lawyers sitting on this jury. So they may have thought, well, he didn't get death. He wasn't eligible for death. So
well,
what was less than the maximum?
He didn't get life without parole if he had an out date.
Again, Judge, but there's a big difference. Again, it's the extent of the deal, I think, that we're looking at and why this man was so. Because an out date, something where you're sitting there saying, 20 years. If I've got a 20-year sentence, I'm serving substantially less than 20 years. I'm out on the streets pretty darn quick. But if I'm going to put a perjury charge on that's going to give me a life sentence that they're going to stack, that's a pretty darn good incentive to say, sure, Vince McFadden is the shooter.
Can you address the Batson issues?
Certainly, Judge. Again, this is, as you all well know, this is on retrial from two Batson reversals in this case. And Judge, first I'll deal with the strike for cause, if that's a
Kerr and Burke, either. Or
pardon
both.
Me, Mark Kerr.
Kerr and Ms. Burke, which is the peremptory.
Pardon me.
The for cause and the peremptory, both.
Right.
If you would.
What was interesting, I think, about this case was that despite, give me a second.
Or Bryant, I'm sorry.
Right.
Kerr and Bryant.
Yeah. The Kerr case, or the Mr. Kerr, to me was problematic. Primarily because when you look at Mr. Kerr's responses, if his responses might have been sufficient for a peremptory, might, and certainly would have been subject to a Batson challenge upon his responses that he was hesitating a little bit. And again, when you look at the combination of the peremptories and this cause strike of these African Americans, Mr. Lerner kept using the same, and I'll use them, code words. He used code words that the Dredke case said you can't be doing. You can't be using these hesitations to establish a reason to strike these people. And every single time he was talking to these African Americans who appeared at the beginning of his panel, and he would ask questions of them, and then he put on the record that they hesitated 20 seconds. Isn't it a miracle that all of these African Americans hesitated 20 seconds before they responded? Mr. Kerr or Carr, it's kind of like Deborah Kerr or Carr, I don't know how to pronounce his name. He hesitated 20 seconds, according to Mr. Lerner, but he never made any responses that would make him excluded for cause.
Well, didn't he, first he said, didn't he, would be beyond all doubt, and then he settled down to when he understood it was...
when he understood the
confidence,
options.
Confidence in the verdict, I think.
Right, and I think that's the critical point, Your Honor, because... His first statement to the court that it was, you know, yeah, I'd require proof beyond all doubt, he qualified that by saying if that's the only choice you're giving me. So when the court actually confirmed with him what the law was and what standard he had to impose, he said, sure, I can look at both punishments. I can be fair and impartial. I can give the death penalty.
The standard for us is that the trial judge is there. The trial judge hears the questioning. Simply because someone says yes, they can, or no, they can't, we don't accept what we read on the paper as being it. That we assume the trial court could look at him, and when he responds yes, maybe he hesitated. And so don't we allow the trial court the discretion to see the witness testifying, and we uphold that discretion? So why would we not do that in this case?
I think
Your
Honor,
maybe the trial court saw that they hesitated 20 seconds.
You know, Your Honor, I think, again, you have to look at where this, number one, you have to look at where this case came from, St. Louis County, that has a history of Batson violations, a history of striking African Americans. And in this case, in fact, when we came down to the peremptories, Mr. Larner went after the four remaining African Americans on the panel, and the trial judge at least was able to and did save three of those final four African Americans. So I think
the choice of words that was able to seems interesting.
It's problematic, I think, Your Honor. I think that, you know, I am troubled by this, by things that come out of this court, St. Louis County, because I see this pattern. I see what's going on in St. Louis County. As to your question about Judge Ross's decisions and Judge Ross being able to look at what Mr. Carr said, what we're looking at in this case is a challenge for cause. What did he say? And was he excludable for cause?
And do you agree that there are cases out there that says the trial judge is not compelled to accept the answer of the presiding person?
I do, Your Honor, but there was nothing that he said that should have given him any reason not to accept it. And again, we have to look at the pattern. I think we do look at the pattern of questioning. His responses were right on target, and in fact, when the court asked the questions, the court was the one that said, "But here's the law, sir."
But isn't the pattern what the trial judge looks at? Doesn't the trial judge look at the pattern of behavior by the prosecutor's office? And don't we rely on the trial judge to factor that in making a decision?
I think trial judges often look at the pattern when they're dealing with peremptory strikes. I don't know that they look at the pattern when they're looking at cause strikes. And indeed, the problem when you look at a cause strike is there is a standard by which someone is excludable for cause. And this man stated on the record he could consider the death penalty, he could impose the death penalty. Every question that he was asked, he said, yes, I can do it. And, you know, his initial responses, again, as the first person on that panel, and I find it, again, troubling when you look at this, each one of these African Americans, these were the first people on this panel to be asked these questions. And if you take a bunch of folks who've never heard any questions like this before, they're not lawyers, they don't know what's coming down, and you ask them a question about the death penalty, isn't a deliberate approach something that we want from jurors? And hesitating 20 seconds, I don't think that's certainly not part of the standard in strikes for cause as enunciated by this court and by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Was hesitation 20 seconds in a courtroom is a lot longer when you start looking at the clock. For 20 seconds, that's inconceivable that they waited 20 seconds for a pause.
Well, and again, Your Honor, I mean, I find it troubling that for each one of these African Americans, we had a 20-second. It was purported to be a 20-second hesitation, and I think we need to look especially again at the Dredke case, because in Dredke, the court specifically said that we can't be focusing on those kinds of hesitations to establish a reason for striking people. I mean, that's part of our jurisprudence in Dredge.
In what context was it said in that case?
The Dredge case talked about it was looking at Batson challenges, but it was the same problem. Is if you establish a pattern and practice of excluding African Americans and you look for a hesitation. That was what the court was looking at, and they said, you know, these excuses given by the prosecutor's office were unacceptable. So I think that's what we have to look at. And if I may briefly address, Your Honor, I see I'm out of time, but if I may briefly address the Batson challenges, again, what we're looking at is a prosecutor who went after the four remaining African Americans, and he sustained the Batson challenges on one or on three, but allowed the peremptory to go forth on the final person.
Doesn't that suggest, though, that the trial judge was really bending over backwards to go through the appropriate steps and apply the appropriate law to the case? I mean, it almost looks like he was doing everything that he thought was appropriate to make sure that this case was tried fairly.
Well, and Your Honor,
Batson issues.
Well, and Your Honor, I think he was cognizant of this court's opinion, the prior McFadden case. I think he was cognizant of that. However, by allowing the peremptory on the one challenge to go through, if you look at that in light of Mr. Larner's history, in light of Mr. Larner's attempts to get the other three African Americans off of this panel, if you look at what he did, he didn't use the same kinds of questioning. Again, it's the disparate questioning that we're looking at, this hesitation that he's using with the African American jurors versus no hesitation talking about it with the Caucasian jurors. I think that's what we have to look at, and it's not simply a question of whether the trial court sustained the Batson challenges on those three. But you have to look at the remaining veneer person and say, was that person unfairly stricken from the panel? Because we're not just looking at Mr. McFadden's right to a fair trial. We're looking at that African American's right to serve.
Well, that'd be true of all the.
Pardon
that
me?
Would be true of all the Batson challenges.
That's exactly. But especially that, you know, we have to look and make sure that that person who didn't get to serve, that her right wasn't unfairly infringed, and that's why this court has to be very careful and not accede to anything that looks like, well, gee, he took care of these other three, so we'll give him a pass on the fourth. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Thompson. You may proceed.
Thank you very much. May it please the court. I'll try to address all of these points in the same order that Ms. Thompson addressed them. If you want to kick me to another point, please do, and I'll address the points that were questioned by the court as well. As to the first point that she addressed, as to the closing arguments of the prosecutor, as was already alluded to, a lot of these points are going to be plain error. They were not objected to. Those are sorted through in the briefs. Don't have time to sort through which was plain error and which isn't right now. However, of course, the point is clear that plain error is rarely grounds for relief on appeal because it's a matter of trial strategy on the part of trial counsel. And also, you have to look at the sum total of the prosecutor's argument. You have to look at things in context and not just isolated context that the prosecutor might have made.
There were an awful lot of things if you look at the sum total of the argument, though. There were a lot of some small errors and some large errors. So is that helpful to look at the whole thing?
Well, it is, and she raises a number of points, of course. I would like to specifically address the personalization as to putting oneself in someone else's shoes. The references here by the prosecutor were to think of the terror that they felt. The story and road situations are asking the jurors to feel what the victim was feeling. Imagine yourself going through it. That's the personalization. That's not what was done here. He just said, think of the terror. This is a totally appropriate argument. I think we should think about what the victim felt. That's the purpose of justice here, and the argument was completely proper on the part of the prosecutor. This is a murder case. It is a death case involving a fairly young victim. The jury is not required to leave emotion at the door. There is going to be some emotion involved. And admittedly, he made some arguments like, well, they could have hunted him down like he deserved. But he also added that we gave him a fair trial. And so he finished that comment by saying, this is what we need to do. We need to give him a fair trial. This is what he deserves. So it was steering the jurors in that direction. It wasn't steering them off in a wonderland of emotion. So, and it certainly wasn't a reference to vigilante justice at all. And as to the arguments about aggravating versus mitigating, we've already alluded to the fact that Douglas was 16 years old, so he sat on cross, and he was asked if he was death eligible. So there is a difference there, and the jury was instructed clearly on aggravating versus mitigating. The jury has to be presumed to follow the instructions.
But didn't he misleadingly tell them that anything that's not, that if he doesn't have a particular mitigating circumstance, like being mentally retarded, being a juvenile, that in itself is aggravating, whereas that's not the law?
Well, of course, we don't have those mitigators here in the trial, though. So the court,
that was his point. Was he? Yeah. Since the absence of a mitigator is itself an aggravator, whereas it's not. That's a misstatement, isn't it?
Well, I think that the jury is going to be guided by the instructions, though, and those are going to state the law, and so.
And so it's okay if you misstate the law in the argument.
Well, I would have to say technically no, except that I think the jury is instructed and they are going to understand that the law sets forth the instructions. That's what the standard set of instructions will say, that you're to be guided by the instructions and that the instructions set forth the law, not the arguments of counsel. So, and of course, there are other points that talk about the instructions on the aggravators and so forth. And so those instructions, of course, are very detailed and set forth quite clearly what can be aggravating. And those, of course, were found by the jury, the serious assault of convictions and the heinous act,
the depravity of mind. You say technically you can misstate the law. What if you said you have to prove the defendant guilty by preponderance of the evidence, although the instructions will say you have to prove by beyond a reasonable doubt? Is that not reversible error?
I believe that there's case law on misstating the burden of proof in arguments, and that wasn't even an issue here. So,
But the point is that the instructions do not necessarily cure errors in statements of the law in closing arguments, so why would it do so here? Because saying, well, we instructed correctly is not in itself sufficient. It may be it's adequate here, but tell me why or why not.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's going to be outcome determinative error, and so it's not going to be prejudicial in that sense. And so guided by the standard of review, it's not reversible.
And why not here when they're saying all sorts of things can be non-statutory aggravating factors where they can't be?
Well, again, the jury is going to have to follow the instructions. They're following the
So we're kind of going circularly. Tell me why that would not prejudice the jury so much that it would affect their ability to follow the instructions, as in when you misinform them about the standard of proof.
Well, I think, again, that the instructions state the law and not the arguments of the prosecutor.
Can you forget the instructions for a minute and tell me about the effect of the argument in addition to the instructions? But some errors in argument can't be cured by instructions. Why is this one of those or not one of those?
Well, it's simply the sum total of the argument, again, that they're not considering those factors. They have to consider the statutory factors and the instructional factors.
The particular part of the argument that we're talking about, the prosecuting attorney didn't say these are not mitigating factors. It was basically in the nature of if they're not too old, they're too young. If they're not this, they're not. If they're not this, they're crazy. I mean, wasn't that more in the nature of what the actual argument was as opposed to what we would think of as an evidentiary discussion of what the mitigating factors were in this case or what the aggravating factors were in this case?
Right. That is a correct characterization, I believe, of what he said. So in sum total, you know, it's not prejudicial and it is not reversible error by any means. I will move on to point one as to the sentencing issue, which I think as has already been discussed, we already had the evidence in front of the jury. He didn't get the max, and he did have a guilty plea. I can separate out the guilt phase and the penalty phase because I think the analyses are a little different there. But in the guilt phase, it's supposedly offered for the purposes of impeachment. Certainly the party may impeach his own witness, but it just wouldn't have added anything to what was already in the record. And as has already been pointed out also, that Douglas was only 16, there are differences there in sentencing anyway. And I think that Douglas made completely inconsistent statements which were brought out to the jury. First, he denied that McFadden was involved. He implicated his own brother in the murder of Todd Franklin. And then he came out later saying, well, sure, yeah, McFadden was the second shooter. And that is how he testified at trial. So, I mean, I'm sorry, but he's such a terrible witness. His credibility was already shot.
The normal standard to impeach just for credibility? You can impeach with the crime that any witness had, which here would be second-degree murder. Can you also impeach with the sentence they receive, or is it just the crime?
Well, as a general rule, it would be what the crime was and what the sentence was. I think this is a departure from the general rule because, for one thing, it's impeaching one's own witness. It's also within the discretion of the trial court. You also already had the information in that it was a guilty plea, which was to murder.
My question is, if it's relevant to credibility in every single case, that you can impeach with what they were convicted of and what the sentence was, doesn't that weigh heavily that that's probative evidence?
Well, for purposes of impeachment, I don't think that this information is going to help any, either in the guilt phase or the penalty phase. It's within the discretion of the trial court.
Why was it so fought so hard to keep out if it wasn't going to make a difference?
Well, I think also in a normal situation that you might see all the time, it's not a related crime. You have a witness who comes in to testify about this crime, but that witness is impeached. Well, yeah, you got that little cocaine possession, don't you? Or that marijuana possession or your DWI or whatever. And it's something that is not related at all. Here, it's the same incident and it's the same type of crime. He's a co-actor. And so I think the possibility of the jury misconstruing things, the prejudice that could result here, is a distinguishing factor. So I think it's definitely within the discretion.
What do you mean by prejudice? How would the state be prejudiced by knowing exactly what the deal was in this case?
Well, I think the idea is that you don't want the jury to run away with, you know, this guy got a plea, this guy didn't get death, this guy got a 20, so why isn't the same true here?
But how's that prejudicial if that's the truth? I guess that's my question. How is the state prejudiced by the jury knowing what the truth was about the deal?
Well, as the trial court said, the sentence of the co-defendant is irrelevant. We have to look at this defendant and what this defendant did.
Why wouldn't it be more appropriate to give a limiting instruction then? I mean, if something like this is goes to his credibility, then the lawyers can sit there and argue all day long about whether or not this guy's a liar because of this, that, or the other thing. I mean, the prejudice that the state would use this information and not punish somebody enough weighed against the fact that he might lie because he got a super deal.
Well, I don't believe that there was a limiting instruction requested to guide the jury, but...
Well, that's my point. I mean, the state fought so hard to keep from getting it in. Why wouldn't the better relief have been... Judge, if you're going to let it in... If you're afraid that they're going to give them too light of a sentence, then you could tell them they shouldn't consider it. In sentencing, this is solely offered for the whether or not he's credible. It doesn't affect the sentence at all.
Well, again, the jury was not it was not requested that the jury be given that limiting instruction.
Right, because the state didn't want the jury to know what the deal was. I mean, that's why it never got to the next step, right? The judge acceded to the state's argument.
Well, yeah, again, though, I mean, I think the jury had so much information in front of it. They have information that he got a plea. They have information he didn't get the mask. They have information that he had an out date. So I don't think there's anything to add by what the...
What if he'd gotten probation, or gotten 5 years, or gotten probation? Or what, would that be relevant? Is there some point where it does make a huge difference? Or are you saying just the amount of time is never relevant?
Well, yeah, I think it's the same thing. I don't think it's relevant.
Normally allow in all that kind of evidence on the issue of credibility, as the other judges have asked? Because that's for the jury to decide whether it would have affected him more or less. But they can't if they don't have that information.
Right. But then again, it's not going to be prejudicial error. I don't think it comes into the harmless error category,
why not?
Because of the degree of evidence that was already in front of the jury as to, you know, didn't get the max, had a plea, had an out date, the whole bit. Again, I just don't see how much this would have added. That the sentence was 20.
Would you agree that it's two separate? Would you agree, though, that it is two separate questions? Number one, whether or not the defense should have been allowed to get to it, and then number two, whether or not it was prejudicial in this case. Would you at least agree that that's two separate issues?
Oh, sure. It always
so,
isn't.
So irrespective of the second issue, did the judge get it right on the first issue in the sense of allowing the actual length of the sentence to be delved into by the defense?
Well, because it's a discretionary call, I believe, yes, he did get it right. I think it's well within the trial court's discretion. But also, there's two different issues because of the different phases. There's a guilt phase argument here, and there's a penalty phase argument. And I did want to say about that, if you're looking at Zant and those sorts of things, really what you want an individualized determination. And if you're giving an individualized determination to this defendant, well, you're looking at what he did. You're not looking at what somebody else did. So I think that's crucial as well. And then, of course, as to the penalty phase, I think this court's opinion in Edwards offered by Judge Wolf is already going to be dispositive of that issue. I guess I will move on to the other points that the court inquired about, which would be point three and point four. As to Kerr, I think some facts are very, very important here, and so I think we need to talk about those, because what his comments were was that the death penalty was administered unfairly. Well, everybody knows that. And justice doesn't get done sometimes. Everybody knows that, don't they? And he was incapable of properly applying the burden of proof.
The death penalty was administered unfairly, and you said everyone knows that?
Well, that's the implication of what he was saying. He was saying, we know that the death penalty is administered unfairly. The justice doesn't get done, and he specifically said, as to the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, his quote was, you need to make sure your stuff is better than that. So he made a number of statements which disqualified him. The attempts at rehabilitation were met with, I guess so, I guess so, I guess so. Those are very equivocal responses. And so the trial court, again, is well within its discretion to uphold the strike against him. The trial court, of course, can give more weight to some responses than others in evaluating the situation. So it is well within the trial court's discretion, not an abuse of discretion. As to the Batson issue, in the time remaining that we have, as to the order of questioning, I think that that's a happenstance. I mean, the prosecutor did not design for people. I'm sorry.
Opposing counsel argues that the prosecutor asked the African American first every time, what do you think about the death penalty? And then the first person pauses. And so they said, well, he paused, he was hesitant. And then it was a pattern of doing that and then saying, well, Your Honor, they hesitated, so they should be stricken. And in fact, the court refused three of the of the strikes.
Right.
Which shows individual consideration, as Judge Fisher noted, but also seems to show a pattern of trying to strike all the African Americans, doesn't it?
Well, I pointed out in great detail in the brief, though, that, I mean, again, in St. Louis County, the questioning is divided up into groups. And so the prosecutor does not design which person is going to be first in the group. He does, of course, ask the questions of the group. And I pointed out other examples, of course, where a Caucasian may have given some hesitation, or he commented on the degree of hesitation. There was at least one Caucasian that demonstrated an ability to follow the burden of proof. There was Jeffries, who was African American, who was questioned. You know, she indicated that she could properly apply the burden of proof, but she simply wasn't reached because of the number of jurors. So I think it's very hard to prove that this was a discriminatory pattern of questioning. I don't think it plays out by the record. To really get to the specifics of the step analysis in Batson, I think this is unquestionably a race-neutral reason. The ability to follow the court's instructions, the ability to apply the burden of proof, those are clearly recognized by this court's decisions, such as Morrow, as they could be a basis for cause strike. So definitely they could be a race-neutral reason as well. And that's all that the state has to show at step two of the Batson analysis. As to the pretext, certainly the defendant would have the burden to show pretext, and that was not met here at all. We certainly don't have a situation where similarly situated people were not struck. And I realize that's not dispositive under Bateman, but it is an important consideration, definitely. Definitely the reasons for the strike were very, very relevant to the case. They were legitimate. And, of course, the demeanor is absolutely essential and crucial, I think, in a lot of these cases. That's why we have to give deference to the trial court's determination, because the hesitation issue, again, is also recognized by this court's decisions as a legitimate consideration. But then again, with all due respect to appellate lawyers and appellate judges, we weren't there, were we? I mean, we'd give deference to the trial court because I doubt that Mr. Larner had a stopwatch, but when he says there was a 20-second hesitation, defense counsel countered by saying, well, so she hesitated a few seconds. That doesn't mean anything. She was first. Well, we don't want to have a swearing match or a shouting match. Was it 20 seconds? Was it a few seconds? Who knows? We weren't there. The trial court was there, and the trial court very specifically noted. He said, well, yeah, there was some hesitancy on her part. Her responses indicated that. So we clearly have a race-neutral reason, and we have a lack of showing a pretext on the part of the appellant. If there are not any further questions, I think that would address the concerns.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And please affirm the conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Ms. Thompson.
Just briefly, Your Honor. Thank you. I think the state would have this court ignore the inflammatory arguments in which Mr. Larner engaged by referring this court to the instructions. Well, one part of the instructions, if I may, says, consider everything you've heard in both phases of this trial. And part of that was what they heard. Part of that was what they heard when he said, you know, we'd send those families out to take care of him. So hand them a rope and...
Well, the instructions specifically say that what the statements by lawyers made during closing and stuff are not evidence.
They
so
do.
So they're told not to consider
They're told that. Not to consider them, but there's a whole body of decisions by this court and by other courts that say, in fact, those arguments can be so outrageous as to violate due process, as to violate the Eighth Amendment.
And generally, when opposing lawyers think they're so outrageous, they object.
You know, Your Honor, and
generally,
and would to God that would have happened here. Therefore, I would request again that this court resentence Mr. McFadden to life without parole on that claim. As to the remaining claims that we have raised today and discussed here today, as Judge Fisher, as you noted, and in fact as Judge Stith had talked about in the argument on the Jermaine Clark case, you know, Why would the state fight so hard to keep something out if it wasn't important? I think that's critically a critical piece of the analysis. If it wasn't such a big deal, why are you fighting tooth and nail to keep it out? And, you know, it became even more important, I think. It was important in guilt phase, but it was important in penalty phase, where Mr. Larner argued in his closing, he argued specifically that they should sentence Vince to death because he draws others into his web of violence. Look who he drew in, Michael Douglas, 16 years old at the time. So he ruins Michael Douglas's life as well. He's the strong man. He's the leader. So all of a sudden, it again becomes relative culpability. Relative culpability in sentencing. And yet this jury has been denied access to the very information that would say to them, well, what is the appropriate sentence? Is the appropriate sentence in this the death penalty or life without? Mr. Larner thought a 20-year sentence for the co-defendant, who was the first shooter, was ample. But he's seeking death
on
this man.
Usually when the attorney does not object and it becomes plain error, it's a very high burden. Should we be applying a different standard for death penalty cases, where death is the ultimate price, versus what we normally would apply to a plain error?
In the Caldwell case, Judge, the U.S. Supreme Court said that closing arguments in capital cases, especially in penalty phase, must undergo greater scrutiny. And I think that's where this court needs to look. Yes, indeed, most of these arguments were not objected to. But when you have, as Judge Stith alluded to, this, it was as if a drum was pounding, and Mr. Larner went through, or as I told my mom last night, it looked like a law school exam on improper closing argument. How many can you fit into one case? How bad should it get? With every single kind of bad closing argument that went on in this case, I think we have overcome the standard of plain error. This is manifest injustice. I would again request that this court vacate Mr. McFadden's sentence, resentence him to life without parole, and as to the other points in the brief, either grant a new penalty phase, a whole new trial, or again, resentence him to life without parole. Thank you so much.
Very good argument by both counsels. Always good to see public servants doing such a good job.